listening to In Other News on KNBA 90.3 FM, bringing you news and views from the teen perspective, the stuff that matters to us right from our mouths. In Other News is a production of the Alaska Teen Media Institute.
Hi, you're listening to In Other News, a production of the Alaska Teen Media Institute on KNBA 90.3 FM Anchorage. I'm your host, Tiana Johnson. We are proud to announce that our radio show placed third in the Alaska Press Club contest for Best Ongoing Public Affairs.
And I'm your co-host, Chloe Chobel. Thanks for tuning in today.
Last week, ATME brought home four Alaska Press Club awards, and to celebrate, we are playing those stories for you to enjoy. Also, today on the show, we've got a new story from ATME reporter Arena Filipenko. Her story is about a young indie folk band from the Valley. In case you miss anything, all of our work is available on alaskateenmedia.org.
The first story we'll hear today is from me. My story received third place in the Best Education Reporting for Radio. The story is called Aggressors, Victims, and Bystanders. It focuses on an anti-bullying curriculum in the ASD district.
When I first heard that we were doing ABB, I was like, oh no, this is going to be horrible. We're just going to sit there and, you know, have all that gushy stuff. Don't bully, don't make other people feel bad. But this actually was a lot more than that, going in depth in the real life problems.
Gina Lovett is a student at Central Middle School of Science in Anchorage. She and other students seem to know being a jerk is a problem. I've known this since kindergarten. So why now, in middle school, are teachers spending so much time reinforcing this idea?
Do you think learning about bullying helps?
Actually, yes, I do.
This is my health teacher, Jana Walker.
I do think that learning about it helps because a lot of kids, the only information they're getting is from home, and or their neighborhood, or the music they listen to, or the TV that they watch. Sitcoms that we watch, you know, the comedy, little half-hour comedies and stuff, those are full of people being bullies. But we think it's funny because they're making little verbal zingers at people, and we think it's funny and we laugh. But really, if you think about it, they're saying horrible things to each other that would really hurt.
Miss Walker has a clear view of bullying. She was bullied as a kid for being a teacher's pet. Today, she sees people being victimized in and outside of school. It's not just her students, it's adults being picked on as well. It seems as though we all have a general understanding of bullying, yet the problem hasn't gone away.
I believe the teachers need a class too, because it's sad going down the halls and seeing bullying and the teachers act like they don't even see it. So I don't know if they don't know how to tell the kids to stop, or if they don't understand what's going on in the schools.
Teachers do take classes. One program used in the Anchorage School District is called ABB, which stands for Aggressors, Victims, Bystanders. It's a national program that the U.S. Department of Education says is promising for middle school students. Since 1994, ABB has been used by over 1,500 schools nationwide. The Anchorage School District has a coordinator for ABB who helps the teachers learn the program. Despite the fact that teachers take classes and sometimes have been bullied, the language kids use to joke around and insult each other is different from the way things were when our teachers were young. This makes it challenging for adults to recognize the bullying. For example, when Miss Walker was a kid, the word tight meant something was bad. But when she heard the word tight again as a teacher, it meant good.
Unfortunately, a lot of times it's hard to know if it's serious or just being playful.
Jan Davis is the ABB coordinator. She says it can be difficult for kids to realize that they are bullying too. Davis says the ABB curriculum helps students and adults identify what's what.
This teaches kids a whole bunch of ways to get out of a situation while they're keeping face and saving face with other kids also, so no one is being victimized.
Students Gina Lovett and Shannon Croft say that ABB gives kids a chance to hear the lecture, "Don't be a bully," in a different way.
If they just sit there and tell us, don't bully, and don't let others be bullied, get a teacher, get help, that's not going
to
help.
But if you actually have to think and discuss and understand what's going on, it makes it a lot easier to stand up for someone in that kind of a situation.
Some classes that I've had before, they tell you, you know, the whole thing by the book. If somebody's getting bullied, go get a teacher. Well, I like that in our AVB class, we're learning other ways than just that, because you can't always go get a teacher. If somebody's being bullied, you don't feel like you can talk to somebody, but you can learn how to stop it yourself.
Many students agree that AVB is teaching the students the right principles. John Boyack says it doesn't matter where you are, you can't wait around in the hallways and watch things escalate.
And it's not just on school grounds, like, it's on the bus, too, and not just buses or the school. It's like bus stops and all that, all those other places where you see people from your school. It's not just the school building itself, it's wherever you meet those people. It's not confined to just this building.
AVB is not the only class that teaches students about bullying. Miss Walker's health class uses a different curriculum.
The interviews and things that I show in class that I got from, was told to use from the district, I think they're really good. And hearing real life experiences and actually watching a movie where it's going on can be very powerful too than just talking about it, because then the kids actually see it.
No matter what the curriculum, there are some variables that just cannot be controlled. Some teachers communicate the message better than others.
One day we had to go to a different class and it wasn't nearly as interesting.
Miss Davis and others are trying to liven up the classes by making interactive lessons that all teachers can use. Miss Davis says almost every AVB lesson has a role-playing scenario.
Because it's like when you answer the phone, and if you always answer the phone, hello, this is the Davis residence, and then you're told the next day that you need to say something totally different, when it's not a habit, and you pick up the phone and you haven't practiced, you're going to go back to what you had to how you answered it to begin with.
Knowing how to act in a bullying situation should be part of everyone's routine. Just like Miss Davis said, if you get that phone call and don't know what you should say, you're going to be lost. Remember, the phone is going to ring no matter what, just like there are always going to be bullies. With the Alaska Teen Media Institute, this is Chloe Chobel.
That was Aggressors, Victims, and Bystanders by Chloe Chobel. If you're just joining us, that story took third place in the Best Education Reporting for Radio in the Alaska Press Club contest. And just so you know, there is no student division. ATME reporters are competing against other large radio stations and veteran reporters. I think it's time for some music. What do you have for us, Chloe?
Well, the first song we're going to hear is On the Radio, by Regina Spektor, followed by Howling for You by the Black Keys. And then lastly, we're going to have Madness by Use. It's going to get crazy!
This is how it works. It feels a little worse than when we drove our hearse right through that screaming crowd, while laughing up a storm until we were just bone, until it got so warm that none of us could sleep, and all the styrofoam began to melt away. We tried to find some worms to eat in the decay, but none of them were home. Inside the catacomb, a million ancient bees began to sting our knees, while we were on our knees praying that disease would leave the ones we love and never come again. On the radio we heard November rain, that solo's real long, but it's a pretty song. We listened to it twice, cause the DJ was asleep. Bum, ba, bum, ba, bum. This is how it works. You're young until you're not. You love until you don't. You try until you can. Inside yourself, you take the things you like, then try to love the things you took, and then you take that love you made and stick it into someone else's heart, pumping someone else's blood and walking arm in arm. You hope it don't get harmed. You'll hear November rain, that solo's awful long, but it's a good refrain. You'll listen to it twice, 'cause the DJ is asleep. On the radio, on the radio, on the radio, uh-oh. On the radio, uh-oh. On the radio, uh-oh. On the radio.
like some kind of madness was taking control.
Wow, what an awesome song. You're listening to In Other News, a production of the Alaska Teen Media Institute on KNBA 90.3 FM Anchorage. I'm Chloe Chobel.
And I'm Tiana Johnson. Up next is a new story from reporter Arena Filipenko. She interviewed the band Jergeny and Twig. This story is also featured on Alaska News Nightly last night.
Imagine an evening sitting in your living room with dim yellow lights, indie folk music floating throughout the room. You and your friends are sipping some Kaladi coffee. This is what four-piece teen band Jergeny and Twig created at the First Presbyterian Church of Wasilla for their CD release show a few weeks ago. Not to mention, they brought a cake shaped like a banjo. The band met through friends and during choir at Colony High School in Palmer. Member Rainey Hastings explains how they chose the name Jergeny and Twig.
Well, a Jergeny is an Australian songbird whose name translates to made of sound or born of sound. And Twig is also a verb, which most people don't know, which means to understand, especially using your eyes. And I think it's a good metaphor for our style, the way that we like to incorporate words that people don't know, and how all of our lyrics really have a way deeper meaning than what they sound like they mean.
Sunlight stolen by the lilies underneath the bellies and the pile.
From band bios to concert posters and their music, the group has a poetic, folksy style. Their primary instruments are guitar, banjo, violin, and upright bass, and they often take turns playing them.
Another signature part of our band is that we are pretty rich in harmonies. We sing together a lot.
The group's influences are Sufjan Stevens, Fleet Foxes, and Andrew Bird.
I think that what inspires us about Andrew Bird is that he writes the music that he feels like writing, whatever he is inspired to make, regardless of what people expect out of him.
Danny walked on the water, turned land into a door that opened wide into the sky. Sunlight stolen by the lilies underneath the bellies and the bar.
Determined to create an album, the band made a Kickstarter page online. Member Grace Carey said that before they made the page, many of their family and friends didn't know what Kickstarter was. But the group was inspired by Alaskan musician Marion Call, who also completed a successful Kickstarter campaign. She raised over $63,000 for her trip to Europe to tour and record a live album. Taking the lead from Call, Carey and her band set out with a smaller goal of raising enough money to record on their own in the valley.
We were like, we can do that! And so we went on Kickstarter. We spent a long time making a stop-motion-ish video and writing a song for it, coming up with some cool verbiage for the page and some really sweet rewards for the people who donated. Like, say if you gave $75, Rainey is in the process of actually painting them a portrait of their cat. I don't know. It's just a really great thing. We set a goal for $900 and we doubled it actually. We made $1,800 to cover the packaging and the duplication of our album, The Sleepy.
When the funds were raised, Jerigany and Twig purchased a small Pro Tools workstation and recorded everything using just one microphone. Member Alex Lindgren says friends with experience recording helped show them the ropes.
We learned a lot in the process of doing this. The recording part was definitely the easier stretch. Then came the technical things like the mixing and mastering, which was pretty much all learned as we went.
Band member Grace Carey is happy with how the CD turned out.
The results were, like, exceptional and way beyond our expectations, and we're really excited.
Jerigany and Twig will be playing with another local band called Marching Band Solo at Jitters Cafe in Eagle River tomorrow, April 27th, from 3 to 5 p.m. With the Alaska Teen Media Institute, I'm Arena Filipenko.
Great story, Arena. We actually had the band in the studio last month, and they performed. They were amazing. Quick shout out to Miss Fuller, the Spanish teacher at Central. I heard she was listening to the radio story today. And with that, let's continue on with more music. We have The Other Side of Mount Heart Attack by Liars and West Coast by Coconut Records.
Thank you. Second there, I thought you disappeared. It rains a lot this time of year. So we both go together if one falls down. I talk out loud like you're still around. Around, down. No, no. Yeah.
You're listening to In Other News, a production of the Alaska Teen Media Institute on KNBA 90.3 FM Anchorage. Up next, we have another story that received an honor from the Alaska Press Club.
ATME senior reporter Max Youngrice took second place in Best Profile for Radio for his story called David and Ted, and we're about to hear it right now.
I don't believe that life is black and white. I don't believe that everything has to go one way or the other, but I do think that people have a tendency to see things that way. When something happens, they have to fit it into the terms of a story. There has to be a beginning, an ending, a good guy, and a bad guy. And I think that when we view things that way, we start to lose sight of the truth about what happened and who these people were. And I don't think that anybody understands this better than David because of his brother Ted.
Well, it might be interesting to start at the beginning, which is talking a little bit about my family. Yeah, I grew up in a family of four people, mom and dad and my older brother, Ted, and me. Ted is 7.5 years older than me. And from the time I was a child, I realized that he was special. Mostly, I think, in a very good way. He was extremely brilliant. His IQ was measured at 165 when he was, I think, about 13 years old. And, you know, you thought to be a genius at 140. So Ted was remarkably smart. Now, there was also some unease that I felt at times about Ted. I never felt the slightest unease in his presence. I mean, he was a good big brother, but he would isolate himself a lot. He had very few friends in school, and I remember asking our mother, you know, what's up with Ted? Why doesn't he have friends, or why does he behave this way? She said that when Ted was a little baby, 9 months old, he had gotten sick, and they had to take him to the hospital. And in those days, families weren't very welcome at hospitals. It was like they saw the little baby as like a little machine that you fix, and they didn't want the parents getting in the way. So they were only allowed to visit 3 times a week for 2 hours. And it seems like, at least in mom's perception, Ted really lost something during that period in the hospital. I recall her saying to me once, David, don't ever abandon your brother. He probably doesn't remember the hospital experience, but abandonment is what he fears the most. And of course, I was very moved by this story, and I said, oh, Mom, of course, I'd never abandon Ted.
At the age of 16, Ted entered Harvard. It should have been a fresh start.
When Ted was in college, actually, he was terribly stressed. He had volunteered for a psychological experiment of young men at Harvard, and it was an experiment that he was involved in for 3 years, and it was clearly an abusive experiment. It would not pass today's ethical tests for informed consent, respecting the dignity of the, and the experiments involved subjecting young men to stress, having their values, their dignity challenged, and seeing how they would react to that. Might have been 16. I know Mom remembered having to sign a release because he was not yet 18, and her thought at the time was, well, maybe these nice psychologists will help my son with his, you know, social awkwardness. And of course, the likelihood is that they did him grave damage. When I was a junior in college, that summer, Ted was had decided to quit his job, and he had actually decided to go looking for land up in northern Canada. And I joined him for about 6 weeks that summer, and we spent a lot of time camping up through Saskatchewan, British Columbia. We actually made it to the Yukon. I think at one point we wanted to make it to Alaska, never quite made it this far. On the Alcan Highway, and we were close. There were times when I thought, you know, why is Ted so rigid? I remember there was one particular occasion when he was, you know, trying to decide on a piece of land, and he got so shut down. It was like I'd try to engage him in conversation, and he was so troubled by something, or so ambivalent. I'm not sure. I sometimes wondered later if this was the ambivalence of, you know, do I want people or do I not want people? Do I, you know, as Ted grew older and was a teenager, I always get the sense, you know, he didn't need people, or that was the kind of the message or the vibe that came out of my brother. And years later, when he was living in the forest in Montana in this cabin, Mom and Dad started receiving these very, very angry letters from Ted. And the basic gist of those letters was that he's been, you know, unhappy all his life. And now he'd had a lot of time to think about it and try to understand why he was so unhappy. And he told them he felt he was unhappy because they never truly loved him.
When did he start to endorse the views that he endorses now?
I think he was probably in his early 20s. I don't, you know, again, 7.5 years difference. I seem to remember that when I was in high school, so he might have been in his mid-20s, already teaching at Berkeley when he began to talk about, you know, the downside of technology. There was a lot actually in the culture about this. You know, the environmental movement was just getting started. Also in terms of his decision to leave his job and go out to Montana and try to live off the land, there was a whole movement back in the 60s and early 70s about, you know, returning to the earth, returning to the land. So in some sense, you know, there was a cultural context for it that made a lot of sense to me. But it seemed like Ted's views had a kind of obsessive quality about them, so that when we would talk, it would be hard for him to, you know, look at it from any different way. It's like he had this one way of looking at it. So I sometimes had concerns that there was something overly rigid about the belief system, the ideology. At that point, I was living in Texas. I'd visited our parents, and I remember Mom saying, "Gee, Dave, on your way back to Texas, you think you might want to stop off in Montana and see Ted?" You know, Mom's sense of geography was a little skewed there,
right.
You know. But, you know, I did really for her. I knew she was very worried, and I told her, I think, you know, Ted's okay, you know. And his hygiene was really awful, but that was his lifestyle. There were things we couldn't talk about. It seems like more things every year. But in general, I thought he'd found a niche for himself. You know, he didn't seem terribly unhappy. And after that visit, I remember him writing me just a really loving letter of how much he had enjoyed the visit. He said, you know, "David, you seem really happy, and I've never been happy, but it was good to see you in such a good mood." And then little did I know that within a year, you know, as I was preparing to get married, Ted would cut off from me, and that was the last time I would see him until his trial. And at that point, a year earlier, he had killed somebody for the first time.
So, when did you start to have suspicions?
Interesting part of this story is that it was my wife, Linda, who first began to suspect. She was puzzled about her brother-in-law. You know, I tried to explain his views on technology, and she clearly, after reading some of his letters, had persuaded me to see that he was, you know, sick, that he was mentally ill. It was Linda who persuaded me in 1990 to take some of Ted's letters to a psychiatrist to try to figure out what we might be able to do to help him. But in the summer of 1995, she kind of sat me down and said, "David, did you ever imagine, even as a remote possibility, that this Unabomber could be your brother Ted?" Now, you know, a lot of young people don't remember, but back in 1995, you know, the Unabomber was really a public obsession. He was the top of the FBI's most wanted list. The hunt for the Unabomber was the longest running, most expensive criminal investigation in U.S. history, And here I am in my living room, and my wife's saying, "Do you think it's your brother?" But Linda urged me to read the manifesto. Now, the Unabomber, again, a sort of first in history, you have a serial killer writing a document to explain why he's killing people, and he anonymously sent it to the Washington Post, the New York Times, and it was eventually published as a special insert in the Washington Post. And when I began to read it, I thought I would be able to tell Linda that it wasn't Ted's ideology or writing, and instead I began to have this sinking feeling that it just was possible that it could be him. Over the next 3 weeks, we really began to investigate carefully ourselves. I read everything I could find on the Unabomber. I'd saved most of Ted's letters, so I had nearly 100 of his letters saved over the years, some of them touching on the theme of technology. And for weeks, Linda and I would come home from work, and we'd sit on our couch after dinner and compare passages from the manifesto with passages from the letters. And, you know, eventually I got to the point of telling her I thought it was like a 50-50 chance. And so we really have two questions at this point. One question is, you know, is he or isn't he the Unabomber? But the second question is, what do we do about this? And so we ended up sending some letters to a guy who did forensic language analysis, asking him to compare a few of my brother's writings on technology with passages in the manifesto. And he assembled a team of people that told us they thought it was a 60% possibility that, in effect, that my brother had written the manifesto. And at that point, Linda and I, you know, I really felt, we both felt, we couldn't just stand by and wait until somebody else was killed. So we made the decision to contact the authorities.
Did that feel at all like betrayal?
Absolutely. I mean, I felt... Remember the first meeting we had with people from the FBI, and they brought out a map of rural Montana and asked me to point out the spot on the map where my brother lived. And, you know, as I walk and put my finger down on the spot, I realize I could be, you know, sealing my brother's fate. I mean, I could be sending him to his death. When Ted was arrested, I think on April 3rd, 1996, they found lots of incriminating evidence in his cabin. The most chilling thing they found was another live bomb under his bed, wrapped in a package, ready to be mailed to someone. And at that point, I think it was obvious that we had acted for good reason. Ted would have killed somebody else if we had not come forward to stop him.
All right. So, seems to me in the rush for time, something that we have kind of skipped over is how did your mother take the news?
Yeah, I actually had to go and tell Mom that, you know, not only what we suspected, but also the role I'd played in the turning Ted in. And, you know, she'd worried about Ted for years. I knew that she loved both Ted and me with all her heart. What I couldn't predict was how she would deal with this. How would she reconcile it? I was really kind of deathly afraid that I might lose her love when I told her that I'd turned in my own brother. I remember she'd been the one that coached me to say, never abandon your brother. As I began sort of laying it out for her, she kind of looked at me, and it was almost like, she was looking at me with this look of surprise and horror on her face, like she couldn't believe what she was hearing. But she was clearly putting two and two together, and I said, you know, Mom, I think there's a real possibility that Ted might be involved in these bombings. And, you know, her first reaction, Mother's reaction, you know, she just kind of blurted out, oh, don't tell anyone, you know. And then I had to say, well, Mom, I have told, I've actually gone to the FBI. I've been worried. I I couldn't live with myself if somebody else were killed. And I've told them, and they're now investigating Ted. And she just kind of sat in her chair for maybe a minute, and then she slowly got up and walked up to me. I was kind of standing in the middle of the living room, and she just reached her arms up around my neck and put a kiss on my cheek. And the first thing she said was, "David, I can't imagine what you've been struggling with." And then the next thing she said was, "David, I know that you loved Ted. I know that you wouldn't have done this unless you truly felt that you had to." I like to tell a story from the time I think I was about 3 years old that really sort of symbolized, I think, the way Ted and I interacted. When I was about 3 years old, our family had moved from an inner city neighborhood in Chicago out to a home in the suburbs. It was our first, you know, home, house to live in, and it was quite a change for me because we had a backyard, and it was a safe neighborhood, and so I was allowed to go out in the backyard and play. And at the age of three, I was very short, but I used to push my way out through this screen door we had in the back and play around and, you know, meet other children and have a ball. And I remember the only frustration that I experienced at that time was that I couldn't enter the house myself. I was so short, I couldn't quite reach the doorknob on the screen door to pull it open and let myself in. And so I remember standing out on the back porch, like knocking on the door, calling out inside the house, "Mom, Dad, Teddy, come and let me in." And this went on for a while, but I remember one time my brother came out of the house, so he's maybe about 11 years old at this point, but always a very ingenious person. And I saw him fiddling around at the back door, and I walked up there thinking, what's Teddy doing? And what he had done, he had taken a spool of thread from our mother's sewing kit and a hammer and nail from Dad's toolkit in the basement, and he removed the thread from the spool. So he's got this bare spool, he kind of lines it up on the door, puts the nail in the hole in the spool, and he's hammering the spool onto the door. And I'm kind of puzzled, but when he's done, he says, "Dave, see if this works." And all of a sudden I realized what he'd done. He'd made this little makeshift door handle for his little brother.
David Kaczynski to this day works as an anti-death penalty activist alongside his wife, Linda. Ted is serving out his life sentence in a penitentiary in Colorado. I may not believe in black and white, but I do believe in people. From Anchorage, Alaska, this is Max Youngrice.
You're listening to In Other News, a production of the Alaska Teen Media Institute on KNBA 90.3 FM Anchorage. That was David and Ted by Max Youngrice. That profile received second place in the Alaska Press Club contest. Now it's time for some events.
Alrighty, I'm your girl from the AK, the one and only Tiana J, and here's some things to do in May. Walk MS Alaska, May 11th at 9 a.m. at Lake Hood. Participants walk to raise funds on research, programs, and to raise awareness for people who live with multiple sclerosis. For more information, go to walkmsalaska.org. Mother's Day celebration and opening day, May 12th, going from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. Celebrate the special day for mothers while enjoying the center's opening for the summer season. Food, fun, and entertainment is everywhere for all ages to enjoy. Check out alaskanative.net for details. Last but not least, the Gold Nugget Triathlon, May 19th, starting at 9 a.m. at Bartlett High School. This event showcases talented women and girls that train all year round to show dedication in athletics and improving lives. For more information, go to goldnuggettriathlon.com. Well, that's it for events, short and sweet. So, now it's time for our final story of the day, and this also was an Alaska Press Club contest winner. This story is from Aviva Hirsch, who took third place in Best Profile for Radio category. This story is called Religion.
On a weekday in the most southern part of Anchorage, Eric and Monica Lucas are at home with their three children. They live in a turquoise house on a looped road and have a feisty black Labrador. Though neither Eric nor Monica grew up in religious households, they have decided to raise their own children to follow God.
My approach to it, I went seeking something that I didn't have growing up.
It was when we went through a spell of infertility that we realized we wanted something different. We were searching for something. Of course, we were searching for a miracle.
She basically was told she was never going to have children from a doctor. So, you know, of course, we took that back to church, back to our congregation and our prayer group and things like that. And they just, they prayed with us and they really worked us through it. It was real family unity and just true compassion. You know, I was still kind of a little on for myself, you know, just I was still new to this. I'm like, what is all of this?
I'm a see it to believe it kind of person.
I'm saying it probably took us a year, you know, of that. Maybe not quite a year.
So for me, when God showed up for us by allowing me to get pregnant with our first child, that was, it just changed our, turned our lives around.
We consider Madison, she's our miracle baby. Well, all three of them are because they said she would never have children, and we have three of them.
So the Lucases became more serious about their Christian beliefs, bringing them into their home.
The way they've raised me, I guess it's cool being a Christian because there's ways that I know that we handle things that other people might not know. They tell us, you know, they want us to realize what's healthy from unhealthy in, like, relationships or anything else outside of the house.
Through homeschool, the Lucases are able to keep their children close while bringing Christianity to their curriculum without the expense of private school.
You know, the public school wasn't offering that. You know, they were too busy trying to pull God out of school, and we were wanting to keep God as the foundation and build up from there.
You are like the cell phone that God created, but yet he hasn't downloaded all the apps into your phone yet. So you're not quite ready to go out there on the market because you don't have all your apps yet. And the girls really like that analogy, and it really works for them. And so now that they're looking at each other and they're saying, we don't have all our apps yet, we're not ready. You know, and they believe that and they understand it.
I like the flexibility of being able to be taught the Christian ways in my schooling, because I've heard that sometimes it's not taught in schools or something.
Monica says that having a faith community to live this life with helps them instill values in their kids.
Because we're constantly learning new ways of looking at how to raise them in ways that would be pleasing to God. And I don't know that we could have raised them the same way had we not had our faith practice in place. I think that we would struggle more. I think that we would rely more on the ways of the world versus the ways of God.
Near downtown Anchorage, Sharon Barr and John Bernitz live within walking distance of both their children's public schools. John says that earlier on, his kids had difficulty identifying themselves because while their mom is Jewish, he wasn't raised that way.
Even though all four of my grandparents were, so it's like, well, are you really Jewish or not Jewish? I was raised that religion is sort of a bad thing, not a good thing. And so I don't remember ever really having belief that there was a God. You know, it's not like I think I'm the most powerful thing out there. I know there's something more powerful than me, but I just don't think it really has a personal interest in me or anything I do. And I envy those who think that God really cares about them, or that there is a God that cares about them.
You know, as a family, we're very politically, I guess, liberal or progressive, and I think that may be what's formed them more than any religious values. Although they do, you know, identify as being Jewish, and they've been to synagogue and that sort of thing. I grew up in a pretty, I guess, a conservative Jewish household, but I went to, you know, Hebrew school for, like, you know, seemed like a million years.
Nathan, the couple's oldest, tells people he's Jewish in a secular way. While he decided to have a bar mitzvah, his brother Sam chose against it.
My parents didn't make me have a bar mitzvah. It was my choice.
I think they spend more time with him talking about religion just because he
cared about it more and was more into it. I think I'm more of a scientific-minded person.
What do you think are some core Jewish beliefs?
There's like the treat everyone as you would like to be treated.
It's like the core Jewish belief is to do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Back in South Anchorage, Monica Lucas.
The one value that I try to instill in my children is to treat others the way you want to be treated.
A concept of nearly all religions. Perhaps the golden rule can be found in every home where parents are trying to raise moral children. With the Alaska Teen Media Institute, I'm Aviva Hirsch.
You're listening to In Other News, a production of the Alaska Teen Media Institute on KNBA 90.3 FM Anchorage. Well, everyone, that's the show for today. We'd like to thank Chloe Chobel, Tiana Johnson, Max Youngrice, Aviva Hirsch, and Ariana Filipinico for contributing to our show.
We'd also like to thank Director Rosie Robarts, Assistant Director Robert Starmo, the Spirit of Youth, Alaska Division of Behavioral Health, the Rasmussen Foundation, and Church's Chicken because it's delicious food. If you would like to make great stories as well, join ATME. You can find us online and listen to past stories at alaskateenmedia.org or call us at 272-2864.
And while you're at it, remember to check out the KPASA, Anchorage Events page on Facebook. It's the best place to find local events. And don't forget to tune in to the next broadcast of In Other News on Saturday, May 25th at 4 p.m. right here on KNBA 90.3 FM Anchorage. Goodbye.
See you later.